Dr. and Mrs. Future on KSCO.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Happy Tuesday afternoon, everyone. Future Tuesday, Mrs. Future.
Thank you, honey.
Yeah.
Scorcher out there.
And we have a new person in the studio here.
Yeah. Welcome, Josh. Nice to see a new face out there in the radio land.
Nice to see y'all, too.
Traffic and weather and nice intro.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Welcome to the family. All right. So, what you got for us, dear?
Oh, well, these lazy summer days, what are we going to do? We are getting ready to travel to Canada.
Our annual migration.
Yes, visit my mother. 89 this year.
Ooh. Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah. We're also visiting our buddy, Hal.
Hal Meyer.
Yeah.
Founder of Thought Inc., Thought Institute.
And Roz, his partner. And we'll be out on a lake in the Laurentian Mountains for a week, among other things. So we're looking forward to that, though packing I don't like. And going
small price to
jumping
pay
on these giant tubes for, well, fortunately, it's a nonstop flight.
And we are not going into the heat wave. We are going a little north.
It's a little past the heat wave, too, I think, on the East Coast. So that's good. That's good. We're happy on that front. And today's show, we're going to do our usual news hour. Then after the news hour, we have some old friends, Connie and Andrew, visiting. They were on the show about 9 years ago in the early days.
Yeah, Connie Baxter and Andrew Cameron Bailey.
Yes, and they are a couple in their 70s who gave up their homes and are traveling by an RV and visiting.
Isn't it called a Sprinter?
A Mercedes Sprinter. And visiting some interesting intentional communities and alternative lifestyles for, you know, they're really looking at what are the options for someone at this point in time beyond the nuclear family environment, or even afterwards. What do you do when you retire? Is it inevitable that you go to a nursing home? Are there higher options?
Right.
So we'll talk to them about what they've discovered in their adventures.
And combing the country for options for elders.
Meanwhile, let's get into our news a little bit. In the outer space world, the India, have launched their second moon mission, the Chandrayaan 2, and it was successfully launched Monday.
Yeah, nice picture on the article here.
They're kind of excited because this is a very interesting mission. It not only goes to the moon, but it has a lander. It has a lander on the moon, and then once it's landed on the moon, it has a little rover that comes out and cruises around on the lunar surface.
Isn't that the blueprint for lunar missions?
Well, that's the gold standard right now. You want to be able to land and then run around, you know, explore the surface. So right now, the spacecraft has entered the Earth's orbit. It will stay for 23 days before it begins a series of maneuvers that will take it into lunar orbit. Now, why 23 days? I mean, the Apollo mission only took 4 days to get to Mars. I mean, to get to the moon. Excuse me. What am I saying?
Slow down. Dr. Future.
Yes. Well, they had a much bigger rocket. You know, and you can use much
more.
They
were in a hurry because they were racing with a Russian mission that was trying to upstage them, right?
At the same time.
Was that?
Did you know, during the Apollo 11, which we just celebrated last weekend, their 50th anniversary, that there was a Russian mission, but it wasn't a manned mission, but it was a mission to pick up rocks on the moon and take it back to Russia.
Right, yeah, they were going to land and do a quick little scoop and then head home.
First time in Indian space history, the interplanetary expedition led by two women.
Oh.
Muthiah Vanitha, the project director, and Ritu Karadal, the mission director.
Wow. Well, I wish them luck. I wish them much success in their journey to the moon and back.
There are about 1,000 scientists involved with their project, engineers and staff who worked on it. And their prime minister praised them all, and they're very excited. And they call it a fully indigenous mission.
Right. Okay. So they're relying on the Indian intellectuals to get us there and back again.
Indian at heart and in spirit.
Mm-hmm. Great. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Now, they're going to the South Pole.
Mm-hmm. Of the moon.
Of the moon. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It seems like the South Pole is of great interest to the Chinese as well.
Yeah. Everybody thinks that there's water there. And if we're going to actually do something on the moon, we definitely want to be able to utilize the water.
Water, and I believe magnetometers indicated that there's metal below the surface of the South Pole. The South Pole. So it might have resources that would be very interesting to anyone who wants to establish any lunar presence, like a moon base.
Well, living on the moon presents a lot of very large problems in terms of the temperature. Just the temperature range is pretty challenging.
Right. Super hot in the daytime, super cold at night, like 200 degrees below zero, 200 degrees above zero.
And the days are 15 Earth days long, right?
14.
14,
Yeah, still, that's a long time.
Yeah.
14 days of 200 degree weather.
Right.
It was bad enough getting down here from Boulder Creek today.
And, right.
You know, with the air conditioner failing in our car, that was bad.
Yeah, right. And imagine if when we arrived, we had to like park in an icebox, sub-zero temperatures for 2 weeks while we got ready for it to be sunny again.
You know, this planet is really good for our biology. You got to admit.
The Goldilocks zone.
Not so good for other places. Do we have a caller, Mrs. Fisher?
We do. Huh? Nick from Royal Oaks is ready to tell us something about navigating to the moon. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Nick.
I hear it's 240 degrees above and below zero there.
240, okay. All right. Well, that's even worse than I thought.
Yeah, they say we're going to go to the moon by 25, huh?
That's what NASA says. That's
you
their
know,
plan.
Right now, it is wonderful because our imaginations are being woken up to the one that just went there and their technique of going.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the third trip now? Or yeah, I think
The fourth country. If India makes it, they'll be the fourth country to successfully land on the moon. Right?
Yeah. A big Earth orbit. Oh, land on. Oh, okay.
Yeah, lands on it and then cruises around. Yeah, the Russians have done it as well. And the Israelis tried. They almost succeeded.
Yeah,
crash landed.
Well, the Russians were the first ones to orbit it. And I suppose that worked our imagination well enough to make our deadline before the turn of the...
Well, let's just say it sure lit a fire. It lit a fire under a lot of butts.
But the navigation part, we went backwards. We had a window, we had a crossbar, and we lined it between the Earth and a star. Like you had said, it was 19 degrees or something. And they got to the edge of the moon without even seeing it. I mean, that's going to be the only time, because we're going to go by GPS now. We won't even look at a star, huh?
Yeah, that's true.
GPS in space? Yeah. I don't know if GPS works
NASA has designed a GPS system for the solar system.
Oh, uh-huh. Wouldn't that be called something like an SPS? Like
yeah.
a solar positioning
yeah, it would.
System?
It yeah. would, yes.
All right.
So it's so amazing to see how it happened. But this last guy, Michael Collins, he stood behind the president, and he's still a little dinky. He's the only one who jeopardized that mission. On the way back, they had the computer controls to make precise, timely turns, and he did the wrong turn.
On the way back to the Earth on Apollo 11? That was with Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong.
So did you watch the series there, Nick? Did you watch the Chasing the Moon series in this last week?
The PBS series?
I saw a lot of them. It was so informing as well.
Yeah, it was really well done, wasn't it?
We're going to be so high definition this next time.
Well, you know, I think it is. And not only high definition, but I think if you have a chance to wear a pair of VR goggles, you'll actually feel like you're there. As you'll look around and you'll have the panorama, the full 360 view of the moon, and you'll feel like you're there without having to worry about getting back.
Yeah.
Maybe. And maybe that's the best way for us to travel, so we're virtually there.
That time they had the cart there, the car, was that on the same launch?
The car, that was Apollo 15, 16, and 17.
Well, so they
had the car.
Same
yeah.
car?
They had a little rover. Vehicle and I left it there, so they're sitting there waiting for somebody
was
to use
it. Was that on the same flight?
No, not the 11th flight. The later ones, the 15, 16, and 17.
By itself or with people?
With people. Those are with people.
Go to a break, you guys.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Nick.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. All right. Dr. Future Show. Dr. Mrs. Future Show. We'll be back after break. welcome back to the show, folks. So what did you guys do? What did you gals do for Apollo 11's 50th year celebration? We went to the IONS conference, the Institute of Noetic Sciences, an institute started by Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell. And it was an interesting, eclectic bunch, I must say. I enjoyed quite a few of the presentations. We heard from the likes of Dr. Dean Radin, IONS chief scientist, Lauren Carpenter, who was the founder of Pixar, co-founder, our very own Dr. Bruce Damer, who we've had on the show many times, Charles Eisenstein, who I believe is someone that you related to.
Oh, I thought he was magnificent. Yes, he is a person who is speaking currently about the best ways to approach environmental regenerative solutions to reverse climate change. And he's saying things like the heat waves are a phenomenon of us putting too much pavement down and creating heat sinks. And then that is what's radically changing the climate locally.
But the road system?
Well, the fact that we don't have forests and cover crops and grass on the ground, keeping it cool and shady and sequestering the water in spongy ways is actually the thing we need to focus on if we want to get control of our local climate zones. It was a very insightful way of looking at what we all can do locally to improve our local climate water cycles. The most powerful thing I took away was him saying if we really want to do something about the global climate change, then what we need to focus on is local water, water solutions, and plants and shade, and learn how the local ecosystem actually works.
Yeah, it always comes back to the water and local ecosystems, doesn't it? Microcosm, macrocosm.
Yeah, we can do so much locally without it having to be turning our willpower over to some centralized global authority.
Yeah. I went to some interesting conferences there, too, at their little workshops. Mark Blessoff, who is a IONS conscious aging facilitator, about conscious aging and the whole aging process.
Yeah?
Yeah, and he pointed out how when he would visit his mother in a nursing home, he would kind of tune out all the other people that were there and just make a beeline for his mother and just sort of ignore what else was happening around him. And he felt, well, maybe if he wanted to really tune into her, he'd turn into her environment and who she's spending time with. And so the next time he went to the nursing home, he made a point of meeting the other people there. And he found, surprisingly enough, that he made a number of good connections with people and that it humanized the experience dramatically for him.
And, wow.
Yeah.
So it wasn't
so just a little bit
of
connectivity. Yeah.
He went beyond seeing it as an institution for his mother and saw it as a society of people.
Yeah, that was interesting.
I really think humanizing is the big missing ingredient on the mainstream news channels these days, is how do we humanize all of our interactions? How do we humanize our understanding of what's going on in every newsworthy situation?
Well, doing what we do best, which is communication. That's what we do as a species. And one of the things that I believe separated us from the Neanderthals because we had better social capacities to connect with each other. And that's one of our saving graces, if you will. So utilize that capacity. And also they found an interesting thing. One of the things they were studying at NIONS was how human attention affects things. And one of the more unusual elements about human awareness was that how it affects random number generators. That you can actually have a group of random number generators and have the background randomness change when something interesting is happening with the people.
Right. So the underlying experiment was trying to measure whether or not there would be a coherence among these random numbers that have been generated for over 20 years now. There's a random number generator that's constantly going all the time, spitting out random numbers. And then researchers will measure some event of mass human coherence when we're all paying attention to the same thing, like, say, during an election or during some national disaster, during 9-1-1. And during those times, the randomness of the numbers is actually less random than at other times. And there's a coherence that is associated with these mass consciousness events.
Yeah, how is it that human attention can affect randomness? More anecdotal, common thinking about that would be someone who's on a lucky streak in a casino. There's something about the randomness where they're winning.
Right. So your consciousness,
you're winning all the time. You're not supposed to.
You're in the sweet spot, and you can feel it, and you know it. So you zoom in, and
there's something that we do
can't go wrong.
Have the capacity for changing the background randomness, and so they found that very interesting. And there's a lot of theories coming out from the Rupert Sheldrake was there, and talking about this, and Lorne Carpenter, and they feel that somehow consciousness or human awareness itself is outside of space time. Mm-hmm. That space-time is actually contained within our consciousness.
Right. And there are so many things at the conference that were making that point in different ways.
Yeah, Deepak.
Deepak Chopra gave a very interesting talk about the history of science and scientific thinking and how the materialist view came into being over the last couple of hundred years and has landed us today where the state-of-the-art scientific knowledge is that there are more mysteries than there is knowledge. Mm.
But I did notice a lot of people speaking about the consciousness field. And you know what it reminds me of?
What?
The Force.
The Force!
The Force.
Let the Force
be with
like us.
Maybe there is something to the Force, the idea of interpenetrating a field that we can tune into.
Use the Force.
Yes.
Life creates it. Makes it grow. Its energy surrounds us and binds us. Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. You must feel the Force around you, here, between you, me, the tree, the rock, everywhere.
I think more and more the scientists are starting to head in that direction.
Well, and yet what the ion scientists are discovering is that they don't know what the source is. They're merely measuring the presence of it. They have data that shows that there's something going on.
Well, Dr. Lipton, Bruce Lipton points out that protein antennas on every single cell pick up this field and that we're walking through this field. It's not empty space when we're walking around a room. It's actually a field in there that's picking up intelligent information. The field is not just like electricity, but it has intelligence in it of mm-hmm. some sort. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're studying now. Is there's an interaction, like the brain is some kind of like interactive, multidimensional television radio transceiver. Mm-hmm. And that we're picking up and transmitting information all the time in many different ways, mm-hmm. including to and from our senses.
Mm-hmm. Right. You actually have an article, I don't know if you're trying to segue over to it, but your article about the physicist Dr. Wheeler.
Yeah, so fascinating. It gives you an overview of all this kind of thinking about the field and quantum mechanics and the discoveries over time. It's kind of a very nice encapsulation of this kind of thinking. We have that on our links page.
I think we should go through it. I think it really is a wonderful little thought experiment. Although, you know,
we
a
only
minute
have 1 minute
is probably not enough time for
and,
that.
And talking about the history of the field. Yeah, I think that's a whole show in and of itself, Mrs. Future. I'd like to cover some of the other news stories while we have a moment.
Well,
maybe we can talk about it with Connie and Andrew in the second hour there.
Okay.
I think they've written a book that sort of touches on these things.
All right. Yeah. So do you have something quick you want to squeeze into the next 30 seconds?
Yes, I really like the way the Washington Monument was turned into a giant Saturn V rocket.
Oh, that was great.
I have a link to that, too.
Projection animation.
Yeah. What a perfect thing to project the Saturn V rocket onto. And they actually have it lifting off.
It's one of the best ways to see a rocket liftoff is projected onto the Washington
pretty cool.
Monument.
Yeah, definitely.
It keeps the rocket
video.
Centered so that you can really see all of its stages of liftoff, and it focuses on the nose cone and things like that. I mean,
yes, it was awesome. So I would definitely watch that. Watch the Washington Monument take off. It's really a secret spaceship.
Five, four, three, two, one.
So that was a big deal project. It wasn't quite as big as the Apollo mission itself, but it required the organization and teamwork of many people to get it down right. And a fascinating link to that whole story that happened in Washington this weekend. So we continue after the news. We've got a number of other stories I want to share with you, including $1 billion that Microsoft recently invested. Back to the show. SpaceX hosted its fourth annual SpaceX Hyperloop pod competition this weekend.
All right.
As
little
well as
bobsleds that
stuff.
Are traveling on the Hyperloop.
The tubes through which you can run a vehicle at very high speed. They had a group from Germany, from the Technical University of Munich, or TUM for short, that took home the win thanks to their achieving the top speed of any of the teams in the finals. And what was that top speed, you might wonder? It was 288 miles an hour. 288. That's the fastest overall for a Hyperloop pod thus far. The record last year was 284. So a little bit improvement. 4 miles an hour. The whole SpaceX student runoff wasn't without incident, however. Near the end of the run, there was a spark and some debris appeared to fly off the craft.
Ooh.
But it survived intact enough for the judges to qualify it for the win.
All right.
Yeah, it would have been faster.
I see.
Hadn't been for that.
288 miles an hour yeah. And stuff's flying.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
The other final competitors were Delft Hyperloop, EPFL Hyperloop, and SwissLoop. And Delft had a communication error that cut their run short at about 650 feet into their 3/4 mile SpaceX Hyperloop test track. And EPFL had a top speed of 148. And Swiss Loop topped out at 160.
Wow.
Yes.
All right. So this traveling in a vacuum tube is slated to become the next form of mass transportation, right?
Yeah, it should be in the Olympics. I mean, these things are roughly the size of bobsleds.
Uh-huh.
But they're little more than engines on wheels on a single track. And it runs the entire length of the Hyperloop test tube. The tube is sealed, is depressurized in near vacuum. Which is how Musk's concept is, that super speed is happening by having a low air resistance.
Sure. Yeah. That way you don't have to have a whole bunch of fuel, right?
Yeah. And there were a total of 21 teams with 700 people taking part in the competition. Mm-hmm. Locally, we had Cal Poly with a pod. There was also the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Indian Institute of Technology, University of Windsor, St. Clair College. Pretty cool. And the teams had to prove to their SpaceX and Boring company staff advisors they were ready to run the tube. And they spent 2 weeks prior to the contest practicing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Break a pod.
But of those 21 teams, only 4 finalists got the green light to run the final competition.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nobody else made the cut, huh?
Yeah. There's kind of a good luck mantra. They had say, break a pod before you run. But actually, they don't want that to happen.
Yeah, they don't want the pod to be stuck with wreck in the middle.
The winning one did kind of break at the last minute.
They have to get all the way. They have to get within 100 feet of the far end of the tube before they stop. That's the criteria.
Mm-hmm. And also, for the first time, all the pods had to use their own communication systems. Another level of complexity.
Uh-huh. Yeah, boy. And how far did they have to go?
3/4 mile was the whole track. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're going to build a bigger one. I think that's the one thing that's come out of this is that we need a bigger track. 3/4 mile is nothing. Come on. We got to go further.
All right. Well, I see a bunch of future Tesla employees here, people working on this stuff.
Yep. It's a thing. That was also this weekend.
Okay. All right. Well, that's this competition. I'm sure there'll be a few more in the future until they get it down.
That's right. That's the pod. Now, SpaceX is busy doing its own thing, too, with space.
Sure.
I mean, this is a big week for SpaceX as well. They have an important Falcon 9 launch coming up for NASA. That's tomorrow, if the weather holds up. Mm-hmm. And they're launching their cargo supply mission to the International Space Station. They're bringing about 2.5 metric tons of supplies, science experiments, equipment for the lab. This will be the 18th supply mission SpaceX has flown for NASA. 18. Wow. Amazing.
Keeping it up there. It's like the Wells Fargo wagon coming to the International Space Station, right? Here comes the Falcon. I hope they got something just for me.
Yeah, would I order that thing from Amazon? I hope it arrives.
Is there a drone in your future coming to the International Space Station?
My space drone that can fly outside the station?
Right.
They only have a 70% chance of the weather. It might go down, but we'll see.
Oh, the weather's not too good in Cape Canaveral tomorrow, huh?
No, it doesn't look too great, but we'll see. The Dragon capsule they're sending up, that's the capsule in which we'll be sending humans to the space station. It's not people in it, just supplies in this case.
I see. They're testing it out,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, yeah.
First, they'll just send stuff, and once they know it's safe, then
people.
Some brave people.
Yes.
And the final seconds
nine,
now.
8, 7, 6, 5.
4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. And liftoff of the Falcon 9 rocket and the Dragon spacecraft. On the heels of the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11's return from the moon, we send more science and supplies up to the International Space Station.
Also, the SpaceX employees have been hard at work in southern Texas. They're working on a prototype Starship. This is ultimately the ship that will go to Mars. Their latest test is to have, they call it the Starhopper, to take off vertically and land.
Oh, okay.
The hop test, they call it, untethered.
So this is the Starhopper is meant to be, once they land on a planet like Mars, then it'll be the local transport.
Well, yeah, you want your spaceship to be able to take off and go sideways and then come down again.
Right. So yeah. It's a VTOL for Mars.
Move horizontally relative to the surface and then land. And they haven't done this yet, so this is a big deal. The test this coming week, I believe it's this week, yeah, 20 meters. They're going to rise about 60 feet, and then move horizontally and then land untethered.
Oh, boy.
For this test, the Starship will be powered by six Raptor engines, and land and take off with hopefully for moon shots and Mars shots. It will serve as the upper stage for a large booster SpaceX is also developing called Super Heavy.
Okay.
Yeah. The Super Heavy has 35 Raptor engines in it. 35.
Wow. And this one only has one.
Yeah.
And it's just meant to be kind of up at the top of all the boosters, right? This is like the equivalent of a lunar lander.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's in Boca Chica, Texas.
Uh-huh.
One Raptor engine to the Starship prototype. Yeah, they've already got it in place. They test fired the engine on July 16th for 5 seconds. And it went really well, except that after they turned off the engine, a secondary fireball briefly engulfed the entire ship.
Oops.
Yeah, you know, it looked dramatic, but it didn't really sustain any significant damage.
Uh-huh.
They've been getting ready.
It's fireproof.
Yeah, fireballs are...
Fireball proof.
Yeah, they didn't. It's still okay. Thank goodness. Happened at the end of the test.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. So that's what's happening at SpaceX. Those two things, the trip to the ISS and the test of the Starhopper.
Mm-hmm.
Now, back on Earth, Microsoft has moved $1 billion in the direction of Elon Musk.
Mm.
His company, OpenAI. You heard of that?
OpenAI.
It was a couple of years ago that Musk had spoken of the potential dangers of AI.
Yeah, he was a pretty outspoken critic.
Even though the Teslas are the most autonomous of all the commercially available vehicles currently.
Right. Well, he's talking about bad AIs, but he wants there to be lots of good AIs.
Yes. Yes. So Microsoft is now invested in OpenAI, and they have some ideas. They want to run things through the cloud. They want to build what they call artificial general intelligence, or AGI. AGI. Mm. It's a technology that some say will match or exceed our intellect, our human intellect.
Mm-hmm.
And also the other news that they've been having in the AI world lately is that AI can basically beat all human gamers already And they're also into getting the AIs to write unbelievably fake news. Well, fake news.
Right. Yeah, we reported on that. We have AI teams that are paired up. So there's one AI that's busy generating fake news. And then there's another AI that's job is to figure out if what it's reading is generated from an AI or not. Right. And the two of them team up to become better gamers at identifying fake news.
I guess you might call them binaries.
Right, exactly.
Play off of each other.
That's right.
And the other big thing is robotic hands. They're really into creating highly dexterous hands right now, really fine control.
Mm.
Those are the kind of the initial focuses of OpenAI.
Wow.
Yeah. They're looking at how to embed the technology more and more into the human experience. Sensors connected to the brain. Well, that's basically what our senses are. They are like sensors embedded into the brain.
Why do you think we call them senses?
Right. Right. They're portals into hearing and sight and taste and touch and smell.
And when we're born, they don't work. When we're born, our eyes don't work. Our ears don't work. Well, maybe our ears do because they've been listening while they're in the womb. But they've conducted all these experiments that if a little baby isn't stimulated with light and sound and touch, then those parts of the brain never develop.
Right, right. And they need the stimulation.
And it really leads to the question of that what we experience is a phenomenon in our brain which was trained to perceive those things. And so those things themselves, we don't necessarily know the exact nature of. All we know is our own response to them, what our sensors make of them.
Yeah, so we're creating more sensors for ourselves, essentially, and using our technology to facilitate that process.
We're going to have to talk about it more after the break.
Alrighty. All right. This is the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show. We'll be back after the break. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to the show. In the Apple world, there's been a release of some information about Apple's glasses.
Apple's glasses.
Right. The AR glasses didn't quite work out for them. So they're working on something they're calling mixed reality headsets.
Oh.
Yes. Mixed reality headsets. Now, they're looking at potential release of 2020. Next year for this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically looks like, from what they have of the stuff that's been leaked, they look like regular glasses almost.
Those look nice.
Yeah, really nice designer
aviator
glasses.
Style.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And they don't have those little crow's feet that I hate. There's nice.
Yeah, they don't look like technology. They look like really
holder.
Cool mm-hmm. glasses. But the glasses have a computer component to them where they superimpose on reality the computer screen, mm-hmm. so to speak. But it's more than just a screen, because when you look through these, you'll be able to see other creatures and things, not just text and words. You'll be able to see movies, AR type.
Yeah, anything you can superimpose on the eyeglasses as a screen.
Yeah, anything right? that your phone can do, your glasses will do.
Can do better.
Yeah. Mixed reality headsets.
Uh-huh. Okay. So now, this obviously is a leaked image. We don't know the truthfulness of what this looks like. No, it's not like Apple said, here's our new product.
Well, this rather than overlaying 3D computer graphics on your actual view of the world, like the HoloLens from Microsoft, mixed reality glasses take the video capture with the camera that's built into the glasses and the synthetic images of the computer and combine the two, the camera information with the synthetic image, to create a video that combines both.
Well, but the thing is, if they're glasses, it doesn't need to have a camera projector for what you're seeing, because you're seeing it. But I guess for the computer to know what you're seeing, it needs to take it in as a camera. But you don't need it.
I think we'll see. There are different versions of this. If you look at the new Oculus Quest, they have this kind of feature as well.
Mm.
Where if you go outside of your play area in virtual reality, the cameras turn on and you see
the actual room you're in.
So you don't run into the chair or table or something.
Right. All right. I guess it's better to have a camera image than nothing at all and bumping into the wall.
It also tracks your expressions so that your avatar in virtual space exhibits your expressions.
Okay.
When you smile, your avatar smiles.
So this camera is on your glasses and it knows if you're smiling?
Well, there's one that's facing towards you as well as away from you.
I guess that I have to imagine it because this picture of the glasses, I can't imagine where a camera would be placed that could do that. But this isn't the real picture.
Yeah, no, this is what's coming. And this is the Dr. Mrs. Future show. So we're going to show you what's coming up, eh?
Yeah, we're speculating.
2020. No, this is actual leaked, potentially fake information, but hopefully not. Hopefully it's the real. This is from Tom's Guide, which is one of my favorite sites for looking at what's coming next. They're usually pretty good about vetting the stories. If this does work, it could replace carrying a phone around with you instead of everyone looking. And then the phone is causing a lot of headaches, literally, and people having problems with looking down all the time.
Oh, sure. On the phone. Bad for your neck. Not a very natural
animal kind of
position.
Thing. I read some stories about how some people are developing bone spurs from looking down at their phone too much.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Oh, so we're going to fix that by having them use glasses all the time and go back to sitting up straight.
Now, hopefully something will. Glasses we're used to for at least several hundred years now as an extension of who we are. Hopefully the glasses format will prevail.
Well, it might help with the neck, but it's not going to help very much with your eyes. I mean, glasses make it very difficult for you to maintain your normal focal range because you adjust to the glasses instead of the world around you.
Yeah, I guess the danger could get people even more distracted.
Well, it'll just make them dependent on the glasses instead of on their eyes. Your eyes will be trained to work with the glasses, so when you take them off, they won't work as well.
Probably something like that. We might have glasses addiction.
Well, the problem with having our adaptable senses is that they actually use the data that's in front of them to tell your brain what you want to experience.
Yeah. I suppose contact lenses might be next for this sort of thing.
Maybe. I can only imagine. I think something that recognizes that we like to use our eyes for the real world as much as we like to use it for this new invented world, you know.
We want the best of both worlds.
Best of both worlds.
The glasses, what's nice is that you can take them off.
You
know,
sure.
To have glasses you can't take off would be concerning. But then that might be possible soon. There was a very interesting article. You remember how we've often talked about in biogenetic engineering, there's these new editing tools called CRISPR-Cas9.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that evolved to CRISPR-Cas13.
There's a lot of CRISPRs now.
These are editing tools for the DNA, and now they're targeting RNA molecules, not just DNA molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's a new system called LEAPER, LEAPER.
Mm-hmm.
It also is focused more on RNA than DNA. And it allows edits with less unwanted cellular immune responses.
Oh.
That's so important. And they don't get rejected as much, which would be good. So if you have debilitating genetic disorders like Hurler syndrome, LEAPER can correct a sufficient amounts of the cell's mutated RNA to make people better. The research is still in its early stages. It's only into animal testing right now. So we don't know about LEAPER in terms of its ability to dethrone CRISPR as the preeminent gene editing technology just yet. That's on the horizon. LEAPER. You may hear about it from other sources soon. But meanwhile, you heard it here first.
Okay. A better
LEAPER
cellular
editor.
DNA
CRISPR-Cas9
editor. It's an RNA editor.
RNA editor.
Not a DNA editor.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. RNA is less dangerous to your system.
Good to know. Glad to hear it. More?
Okay. More stories.
More stories.
Another interesting, we've heard more and more about autonomous flying taxis.
Yes.
So you'll be able to call one up on your phone or soon glasses, and they'll pick you up and swoop down and take you to where you want to go.
Oh, sure. Everybody wants the Jetsons to be real tomorrow.
Right? And there's 100 electric air taxi designs already in the works right now, including Airbus Vahana, the German Volocopter, Uber's Elevate project.
But all of those can fly for about 15 minutes before they need new batteries.
Yeah, batteries, 15-minute flights. That's
not
a real
problem.
Not
exactly a taxi.
My goodness. How did that happen?
Uh-huh.
Batteries. Okay, so we got a new one that uses, instead of batteries, hydrogen fuel cells.
Okay.
Okay, this is a Massachusetts-based Alakahai Technologies. They say hydrogen fuel cells will give their six-rotor air taxi greater range. In other words, we can fly for, let's see, five people or 1,000 pounds of cargo for 400 miles. Two to four hours of flight.
That's quite a leap.
Yes.
That sounds almost useful.
Yes. It's more like a normal airplane in that sense, right?
Uh-huh.
They can carry 2.5 times more payload than the electrics and carry it for 8 times as long. And that means that The unit called the Sky, S-K-A-I, Sky, I guess, another way of saying Sky, that can fly between cities instead of just on short hops within a city.
I'm sure there's a lot of people who want to do that.
Yes, and it could also do air ambulance work, and it could do freight delivery, disaster relief tasks, all these sorts of infrastructure things. That,
they just need to have some hydrogen fueling stations, right?
Yeah.
Hydrogen fuel cells. Now, hydrogen in that case is a fuel that you have to add, right?
Well, fuel cells use chemical reactions between stored hydrogen and oxygen from the air to create electricity and pure water. Oh. So you have stored hydrogen and it interacts with oxygen in the air.
Now, stored hydrogen has its own issues, doesn't it?
How do you store hydrogen? Yeah, there are some danger to that. But then tanks of gasoline are kind of dangerous too.
I suppose so.
Yeah. And hydrogen can be made pretty cleanly using electricity and water. And hydrogen fuel cells can actually be an alternative to batteries for storing electricity.
Hmm.
Right now, batteries are currently favored for electric cars, but the fuel cells are increasingly being used for larger electric vehicles like trucks and buses and trains, where electricity from the hydrogen fuel cell is actually more economical than batteries on that scale.
Right. So the thing is, they think that they can get these out there fairly quickly if the FAA approves it, but what they really want is for it to be totally autonomous, right?
That's the direction they're heading in. Yeah, the autonomy, where it's automated, where basically transportation follows the flow of communication. How we now have cheap global phone calls, we're going to have cheap transportation around the planet places. So that's the direction we're headed in with this. Like a circulatory system, a planetary circulatory system for us.
All right, well, that's it for this hour.
Yeah.
KSEO Santa Cruz and Dr. and Mrs. Future. I'm going to head out for a little break, and you guys are going to get some traffic and weather and news, and then we're going to come back with our guests, Connie Baxter and Andrew Cameron Bailey.
Yes. All right. We'll see you in a few.
KSEO Santa Cruz.